This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. You are unknowingly revealing a trail of information about yourself as you go about your day. The microchips in our cell phones, cable TV boxes, and supermarket scanners record thousands of details about our lives, who we call, what we buy, where we travel, how late we order a drink in a bar, or how early we get coffee at a diner. Our guest Stephen Baker says mathematicians and computer scientists are getting better at sorting through those jillions of little facts to reveal things about us, our tastes, phobias, healthcare issues, political views, even our love interests. Baker calls these Jedi Knights of data analysis the numerati. That's the title of his new book about the people and corporations using advanced math and powerful computers to learn about our lives and make money from what they learn. Stephen Baker has written for Business Week for more than 20 years and is co-author of its blog, blogspotting.net. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies.
Well, Stephen Baker, welcome to Fresh Air. Your book.
Thank you, Dave.
Your book is called The Numerati. It's about all these mathematicians and computer scientists who are going to be managing, accumulating, and analyzing data that tells them things about us. Well, let's talk about some of the ways that these computer whizzes, the numerati as you call them, might work with data in the future. And one of them involves us as shoppers. Now, everybody knows about loyalty cards. We get the little card from our local supermarket or sporting goods store or department store. And whenever we use that, that generates data through the cash register on everything we buy week after week. They get our shopping list. But you note that the supermarkets, for example, haven't really done much with that data until now. What are some of the ways that computer technicians see for retailers to use all of this information they get?
Well, right now, if you walk into a grocery store, they don't know who you are until you check out. And so they can't take advantage of everything that they know about you and haven't bothered to do that yet. But what they want to do is have you identified as you enter the store, either with a shopping card or a loyalty card that has a radio signal on it, and then they'll know who you are, and they'll look at the patterns of your shopping and other people that they think shop like you, and they'll make suggestions, almost the way Amazon or Netflix make suggestions about which movies you might like to watch or what books you might want to read, and they'll try to put us in different tribes or buckets of people according to our preferences. So me, for example, I'm a guy who I'm kind of a cheapskate, and if a recipe calls for red bell peppers, I tend to buy the green ones sometimes because the red ones cost twice as much. So they might say, we've got a group of people that consistently buy green bell peppers instead of red. Now, what else do those people, those cheapskates, buy? And they could profile me as a cheapskate and suggest all kinds of things to me. And it can get incredibly complex.
Now, let's make sure I understand how this physically would work. You or I walk into a grocery store, and we pick up a cart, and there's a computer chip in the cart, and we scan our loyalty card in the cart, or there's a radio signal on the card we carry in our wallet?
Well, Microsoft is rolling out one of these systems, and then there are European companies that are also doing it. And what they want to do is have a little computer terminal on the cart, and you swipe your loyalty card, and it immediately knows who you are and then suggests a shopping list for you. And some people might find this very intrusive.
Yeah,
people may choose not to have it.
Yeah, I can imagine people jumping with fright when they see their shopping list pop up. But let's explore this a moment. So then once you've in effect checked in at the supermarket and they have your entire shopping history there on a big database, they then will offer you specials and coupons that are uniquely tailored to your interests and buying habits?
They're not only tailored to us and what we want to buy, but they're also tailored to what the store wants to sell. They can make all kinds of calculations about how much money they can get out of us and how quickly they can get rid of their surplus. I mean, if a store has a bunch of fish that's going to go rotten, then they can do calculations on how many shoppers are going to they need to send the promotion to, and which type of shoppers, and they want to maximize the amount of money we're spending at the supermarket.
And so some kinds of people will respond to that, and some won't. Now you point out that there are some kinds of shoppers that retailers call barnacles. Who are they?
Right. Barnacles are cheapskates. Barnacles are people who go from one store to the next, always looking for the bargains and not really buying anything else. And the retailers detest barnacles. And now they have the means to explore the patterns of the barnacles and single them out. And once they know who the barnacles are, increasingly they're going to do things to discourage barnacles from even coming into their store. They're going to try to fire the barnacles. They might do this by giving them coupons or advertisements for things that the barnacles would never want or things that are incredibly expensive.
So as for someone who shows a propensity to spend some discretionary income, we'll get a bunch of enticing specials. But if I'm a barnacle, I'm going to get a bunch of stuff that doesn't interest me at all, and I'm going to get bored and leave.
Right.
Now, you point out that there are people who, for example, if there are people who shop on a budget and they will spend so much every week, there are certain kinds of bargains you might not want to offer them. Is that right? If you're a retailer?
Yeah. If you spend $150 a week, then the supermarket doesn't want to sell you anything at a discount, because that means that a higher percentage of what you're spending is discounted and their margins are lower. So they would try to get rid of things on discount to shoppers who aren't on a budget. And they can easily figure out which shoppers are on budgets, because the people regularly spend about the same amount of money.
So if retailers don't want bargain hunters, cheapskates, and would be inclined not to offer them incentives to come back, like discounts, I mean, isn't that kind of discriminatory? I mean, it's often low-income people who are bargain hunters who really need to save money, and this would allow retailers to, in fact, deny savings to the people who most need them.
It is discriminatory, and I think you're going to find, as the numerati expand and develop their power, that in industry after industry, what this knowledge does is it gives them the power to discriminate. We've had the luxury of being treated in groups for millennia, and we benefit from that in lots of ways. Like in insurance, those of us who are healthy subsidize those of us who are less healthy. And because we're ignorant about it, and because the companies are relatively ignorant about it, we can all be satisfied. But as we and they learn more details, then they're going to be able to discriminate against us, and we're going to be able to demand special treatment based on what we know about ourselves. And this kind of breaks the social contract that we've had through the ages.
And to go back to this idea of associations, they might, if they discover that I'm the kind of shopper who might like an expensive or exotic treat, that might mean that I might, when I enter the store, my electronic coupon might pop up for some exotic dessert that my neighbor might not get a coupon for, right?
That's right. I mean, traditionally, retailers have looked at us in the broadest terms. They haven't had the data on individuals, so that they've had to look at us as whites and blacks, or rich and poor, or, you know, the big demographic groups in our society. And they've had to assume that we act more or less like other people in our religion, our race, our zip code. Now they can zero in on us so that they can give your next door neighbor, who in many ways resembles you by the old measurements, a totally different pitch than they give you. And that person might be in a different tribe.
Tribes, people with common habits and tastes and cultural patterns?
Right. But sometimes they're common tastes and cultural patterns that we don't recognize ourselves.
Can you give us an example?
Well, in politics, I talked to a company called Spotlight, and they are trying to put us into different political tribes. And these aren't tribes of Republicans or Democrats and Independents, and they're not soccer moms, and they're not terror-frightened widows, or all the different groups that we've known about in the past. They're trying to figure out what our deepest values are, what our feelings are about things like freedom, community, the outdoors, and they're placing us in these various tribes by going through gazillions and gazillions and gazillions of our personal data. They're going through what we've bought in the past, where we live, how many cats we have in our household, what kind of car we drive, all those things, and they're putting us into these tribes.
That's one area where, you know, for years politicians have been dealing with data on basic demographic variables to predict ideological and voting patterns. And we all know what they are: their gender, their race, their income, their education, their union affiliation, religious affiliation, and so on. Can you really, if you incorporate these hundreds of millions of pieces of seemingly irrelevant data, like whether I go fishing or how many cats I have, do you really get a picture that tells you something that's more – that offers more political insight?
It can. We should make clear that those standard groupings, the hunters, the churchgoers that we're very familiar with, are still extremely useful to the political consultants. And they can get, you know, McCain and Obama, they can get the 45% each of the population through appealing to them the old-fashioned ways. But what they're trying to figure out is where among those – where hidden in a Republican district is a potential Democrat we can turn in Cuyahoga County, Ohio. They're trying to cherry-pick people with this micro-targeting. So it's not for the vast majority of it. It's for special little tribes that they're hoping to nab and then hit them with very, very targeted advertisements. Now the trend is more towards – understanding us more deeply as people and saying this person might be a Democrat, might be a Republican, could go either way. But if we understand this person as a person, we can hone the advertisement and the targeted telephone call or the internet advertisement perfectly for him or her.
So in this election, we're going to see, in effect, individually targeted appeals on what? The internet, phone calls, door hangers?
It's going to be all three of those: internet, phone calls, and people knocking on doors. Okay. And mailings. Mailings are a really easy way to single out people.
If these techniques allow you to find a member of a tribe and find a Democrat in a community full of Republicans and then target ads. I mean, it sounds like an awful lot of effort to identify a voter or a few voters. Is it cost effective? Do you know what they spend doing that?
Well, how much do you think Gore would have spent for 300 Florida voters in the year 2000? The price of a voter is, it's really hard to calculate, because if you win 40% of the vote or 60% of the vote, every additional voter that you get is meaningless. But if you're right at 50, the value goes up dramatically. And it's in the races where they're going to be between 49.5 and 50.5, where they're going to spend a lot of money to get a relative handful of voters. It might be 50, might be 100, but they'll spend quite a bit for those voters.
Well, national security is one area where people have been mining data for a long time. And apparently illegally in some cases, it seems. And I was fascinated by a description you had of a man named Jeff Jonas who had been involved in this and then had come upon a completely different view about the privacy threats to this kind of activity. Tell us about him.
Jeff Jonas is a very unusual guy. He dropped out of high school and started up a software company, and at one point had 20 employees, and a year later he was sleeping in his car, and then he got a broken neck when he was on a test drive to buy a BMW and was paralyzed, and now he does Ironman triathlons. But anyway, he lives in Las Vegas, and he was hired by the casinos to develop a software that would track the data of all kinds of people so that they could try to find the bad guys, the people that were coming in, the criminals or people that were coming in to try to rip off the casinos. And he built a system to do that, and it looks for similar names, similar phone numbers, and goes through massive amounts of data. And the CIA invested in his company. And later, after 9/11, it became very clear that he was onto something that was going to be very useful for national security. So Jeff Jonas, who describes himself as a former beach bum, is now a leading figure in the war on terror. But he really, really objects to statistical data mining, which is really the heart of what the Numerati is all about. So of all the Numerati, he's the dissenting vote.
What use did the CIA make of his techniques? What were they doing in pursuit of terrorists?
Well, they want to get a handle on everybody in the country and everybody in areas that they're studying, and they want to figure out which people are the same people, because they get confused. People have aliases and false names and all kinds of ways of hiding themselves, and so it's a way of sorting out people. That's really what they wanted to do. It's a very basic tool, but it remains a very necessary one in the war against terrorism.
And this came to trouble Jeff Jonas.
Well, what he was seeing and what he sees today is an increasing reliance on statistical data mining. And so what he looks at is, okay, we know this person is associated with some act of terror, you know, the bombing of the USS Cole, for example. We know that. So who does this person know? Well, he knows this person, he calls that person and that person. And so that type of detective work is kind of like old-fashioned sleuthing. You start with a lead and you follow it and you follow all the connections it has. And he's fine with that. What he doesn't like is the idea, okay, how does everybody behave? And are there patterns of their behavior that might indicate that they might be a terrorist? And he thinks that we don't know enough about terrorists to come to those sorts of conclusions, and that the consequences of getting it wrong are much too high. You know, there was this one story that I had that I didn't put in the book because I couldn't confirm it, but I heard that there was an FBI agent on the West Coast who wanted to keep an eye on the hummus consumption around San Francisco. And his idea was that a sharp spike in hummus consumption could tip investigators to the presence of terrorism. Now, that is inane. But there's nothing to protect us in statistical data mining from really, really silly analysis like that. And what's scary about it is, you can have silly analysis, but then you go and find all the numbers and you put it all together and you come up with a conclusion and it's wrapped up as science and math, and yet it's based on stupidity. And that's a real concern for Jonas.
You know, your book is about a world in which data is generated in such gargantuan quantities and shared so widely. And I'm one of those, and many of us are from time to time, where we just want to retreat from all that. I recently had someone walk into a bank branch with my bank account number and a fake ID trying to withdraw money. And I had to close the account and reopen a new one. And then later, when I had to fill out a form to co-sign my college-age daughter's lease, they wanted my bank account number. And I said, you know, I'm not so sure I want to share that number anymore. There are times that I think we just feel like we want to stop using our credit cards, pay with cash, and retreat from all this digital stuff. And you write at the end of this book, you say, these statistical tools are going to be quietly assuming more and more power in our lives. We might as well learn how to grab the controls and use them for our own interests. How does one do that? How does one embrace the world of the Numerati?
Well, I think that there are great opportunities for entrepreneurs, and they're already looking at them, for them to develop tools so that we can monitor our own data and get a sense of who's using it and to what end, so that we can protect it and give it to people that we want, that we trust with it. And we're going to develop relationships with certain companies that we trust with the data and be able to shut it off to other people. And eventually, we could sell our data. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing when we go into a supermarket and give them our customer loyalty card. We're selling our data. We're exchanging it for refund, for discounts. And we'll be able to sell our data. There could be markets that open up for data where we decide, how much of it we want to sell, and at what price.
Well, Stephen Baker, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Stephen Baker is the author of the new book, The Numerati. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies, who is a senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News.